From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for November the 12th, 2017. This is our weekly look at what's going on in politics from City Hall to Springfield, all the way out to Washington, D.C., and even actually to Manila, Philippines this morning, where the president is attending a dinner with Asian leaders. Time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, a big welcome this morning to Eric Rung, who is sitting in for Dave this morning. Welcome to the spin.
Rick, always good to be with you, sir.
Well, and actually, it's good that you have such a smiling face on this miserable Sunday morning. It's miserable outside. It is just drizzly and cold, but it's not as bad as it could be. I will say that much. But I believe out in the far west suburbs, they're like at the freezing point and maybe getting a little bit of more like icy rain and drizzle out there. Not a lot of fun. But downtown, we're close to 40 degrees. Average temperature at this time is 50 degrees. So we're below normal, but nothing new here at Tribune Tower.
I tell you what, it almost makes it a little more cozy just to kind of sit in on a Sunday morning, grab that cup of coffee, like you mentioned. It makes it kind of nice. It makes you realize just how much news we may have been missing over the last week and get ready for this week.
Yeah, if you can ever get ready for the week, that's the hard part is getting ready for the week. But, you know, even just last week with that snow on Friday, that stunned me. I did not see that coming. I mean, I knew there was talk of, you know, some flurries and stuff like that. But, man.
Well, when I walked out of my apartment and saw the snow, I mean, the first thing that came into my mind is, you've got to be kidding me.
First thing that came to your mind was to turn around, go back into your apartment, go back under the covers, probably.
Well, that was definitely right up there. But I did have to leave, unfortunately.
Yeah, me too. But it was like when I got up, it was just flurries. And then when it was, you know, go get showered and everything, then time to go, and it was like sticking, and it was like, wait a minute, stop.
I know,
this.
That's not supposed to happen.
Right.
Especially after the last two winters.
Well, maybe we get this out of the way kind of thing. I know, it's winter time, we should enjoy it.
Well, let's not get carried away here. Let's enjoy it.
I know. Well, you don't know, but we've got the newsroom Zamboni. That's part of your duties, by the way.
Oh, no, they haven't initiated me with that yet.
Yes, in between newscasts, you have to go out here on Pioneer Court and spread the joy so that everybody can go sliding and slipping and falling into the glass of the new Apple store here on Pioneer Court.
I can hardly wait.
Yeah, it's
any training involved in that?
No.
Just put you up there and say, go for it.
Just make circles. You know, it's
it drives itself, sure, right?
Yes. We've got, you know, Bob the engineer's got the thing all oiled up and it's all set to. It's part of the newsroom duties. In the summer, it's the newsroom slip and slide. And in the winter, it's the newsroom Zamboni. That's what we have here at Tribune Tower.
I'm always looking to really expand myself as a person as well as on heavy machinery. So this is going to be a good thing. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, and I love this morning. So I normally come in down at the loading dock entrance downstairs, and there's a wire gate across the front of that. It's closed. So I come up, trudging up the stairs through the rain, come into the front door. That's fine. I go out to the front door later to go get some coffee. Front door is closed because they're installing all of the greenery for the Christmas decorations over the arch of Tribune Tower.
That's what made it real for me. When I was walking into the tower today and I saw the Christmas trees and all the other decorations, and that's when it hit me. This is happening.
I know, but it's not even Thanksgiving yet.
I'm sorry. I think we've lost that war.
We lost it a couple of weeks ago with Halloween. I mean, it was already Christmas, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there. I'm not close to being there.
Oh, no, not at all.
And, I mean, it dawned on me the other day when I was on the bus on State Street and it stopped to pick up some people and I heard the bell ringer. You know, for the Salvation Army.
I have not seen that yet.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Wow. I don't recall ever seeing them before Thanksgiving.
Right.
Yep. That's got to be new.
State and Lake. That was just the other day. So I know. It's just, I'm not anti-Christmas. It's
sure.
just there's a time and a place for everything.
Sure, sure. And it's after Thanksgiving.
And somebody was asking me the other day, what are you doing for Thanksgiving? I said, I'm not even there yet. You know, I mean, I'm just starting to get there yet.
Well, being in the business that we're in, sometimes I forget that it's even coming. So I don't know if that's me or is that just real?
That's real? Eric, that's why I wear a day date watch. Okay. I don't, not just the date. I need the day. So I know what the day of the week is to put in the lead of the newspaper story. Because really, you lose track of
you
what
do.
Day
and
it is.
It's easy to do, especially you know when you're covering Springfield and you're up there too, and you're just constantly moving and grooving, and you got one story leading right into the other. Next thing you know, it's Friday,
and you don't know it until you look at your watch.
I know, it's crazy.
But I mean, I am looking forward to like Thanksgiving, and you don't know this, but I do this jazzed up green bean casserole. We even posted the recipe.
That sounds amazing.
Well, it's pretty good, and it's out of Taste of Home magazine, and it's got your normal green beans and your cream of mushroom soup and that kind of thing, but it's got water chestnuts, bacon, a little bit of Velveeta cheese in it.
Velveeta.
You make it in the crock pot, and then you throw the French fried onions on the top.
Oh wow, that sounds outstanding.
But,
I think I started here at the right time.
But I think I'm going to jazz it up a little more this year. But I got to try it first.
More bacon?
Well, I always double the bacon anyway. No. So I noticed when I was at the grocery store, they have the French fried onions, you know, that you put on.
Mm-hmm.
They have French fried jalapenos.
What?
Yeah. And there's like a Velveeta with jalapeno in it.
Wow.
So I'm thinking, and I was talking to some foodie folks, and I said, you know, jalapenos and green beans, and they're like, oh, yeah, go for it.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to give it a try, and I'll let everybody know.
Are you also going to still make the one without the jazzed up stuff? Just going all in?
I'm going all in.
All right. I like that attitude.
No, I mean, you got to go all in.
Right.
So... but we will post the original recipe, and then I will
parent for the faint of heart, right?
And maybe some green, those little chopped green chilies in it too.
I'm liking everything you're saying right now.
Yeah,
I'm digging it.
It just something different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the original is great, but time to spice things
variety.
Up a little bit. Right?
Variety,
yes, variety is the spice of life. And that's what this show is all about, variety and spice.
That is a fantastic segue. You are a professional, sir.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I tell myself that every day in the mirror. Well, Eric, again, pleasure to have you with us this morning. Eric's in for Dave to keep us up on all the news and sports. Producer Jessica's here to field your phone calls. She's at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, and we're on Twitter @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is putting the finishing touches on the newsroom Zamboni so Eric can get out there on Pioneer Court.
I'm about ready. I'm putting on my jacket now. I got my stocking hat. I'm going to be good to go.
Excellent. Just remember, it only makes right-hand turns.
That's the only way I know how to go anyway. So
We're fine. Fair enough. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts there at WGNRadio.com or by searching iTunes for Rick Pearson. We've got a great show coming up today at 7:30. We're going to talk after the news. We're going to talk to Tom Weitzel. He's the police chief in Riverside. After the 8 o'clock newscast, we're going to speak to Israel's consul general in Chicago, Aviv Ezra. We're going to talk to him about Governor Rauner's recent trip in Israel. And then after a final check of the news and sports at 8:30, we're going to speak to Ray LaHood. He's the former U.S. Transportation Secretary and Congressman from Peoria. And we'll talk about civility or the lack thereof in our politics today. That's all coming up. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on in beautiful Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, a little damp Michigan Avenue this morning, this Sunday morning. Time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, the issue of sexual harassment has now reached into the Alabama U.S. Senate race, with Judge Ray Moore, the Republican candidate, being accused by four women, one as young as age 14 at the time, of inappropriate behavior when the candidate was 32 years old, some 40 years ago. Some Republican senators have told him to drop out. Others hedge their bets and say, if the allegations are true, dot, dot, dot. And then there's the Alabama Republican Party that's standing by Roy Moore. Moore was on Sean Hannity's radio show, and he had this to say.
These allegations are completely false and misleading. But more than that, it hurts me personally because, you know, I'm a father. I have one daughter. I have five granddaughters, and I have a special concern for protection of young ladies. This is really hard to get on our radio and explain this, and as these allegations are just completely false.
Now, the Republican candidate, as I said, coming under increasing pressure. Louisiana's Republican senator this morning on Twitter said that the candidate should step aside. Also, in Alabama, the special election, this, of course, is for the seat that Jeff Sessions held before becoming attorney general. The Alabama governor says that he is not going to change the date of the special election, as some Republicans had been pushing for in the event that Moore was going to step aside. Well, I also want to turn back the clock a week ago. And it's hard to believe it was only a week ago when a mass shooting at a Texas church was in the news. And yes, another mass shooting. The president was traveling in Asia then, where he was asked by NBC News if the extreme vetting that he talks about for immigrants coming into the country perhaps should be used in determining who gets a gun. The president responded, and again, wrongly talked about Chicago.
Well, you know, you're bringing up a situation that probably shouldn't be discussed too much right now. We could let a little time go by, but it's okay if you feel that that's an appropriate question, even though we're the heart of South Korea. I will certainly answer your question. If you did what you're suggesting, there would have been no difference 3 days ago, and you might not have had that very brave person who happened to have a gun or a rifle in his truck go out and shoot him and hit him and neutralize him. And I can only say this. If he didn't have a gun, instead of having 26 dead, he would have had hundreds more dead. So that's the way I feel about it.
And are you considering,
not going to help.
And are you considering any kind of gun control policy going forward?
When you look at the city with the strongest gun laws in our nation is Chicago. Mm-hmm. And Chicago is a disaster. It's a total disaster. Just remember, if this man didn't have a gun or a rifle, you'd be talking about a much worse situation in the great state of Texas.
And those are the thoughts of President Donald Trump. And once again, referring to Chicago and gun laws that, the courts struck down those gun laws. We're obviously dealing with a very serious situation with gun violence in the city of Chicago, but Chicago does not have the strictest gun laws in the nation, and it continues to be repeated by this president. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. President, as I said, is traveling in Asia, landed in the Philippines a couple of hours ago. As he was leaving Vietnam on the Twitter, he responded on Twitter to a tweet from the North Korean government that called him an old lunatic. So the President of the United States responds, "Why would Kim Jong-un insult me by calling me old when I would never call him short and fat? Oh, well, I try so hard to be his friend, and maybe someday that will happen." Yes, folks, don't try this at home. As I said, the president traveling in Asia, speaking in Beijing earlier this week, the president said he didn't blame China for taking advantage of the United States on trade.
"Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one, but I don't blame China." "After all, who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens? I give China great credit."
Now, the president was also in Seoul, South Korea, and there he delivered a warning to Kim Jong-un and the North Korean leadership about their need to de-escalate tensions.
"The weapons you're acquiring are not making you safer. They are putting your regime in grave danger. Every step you take down this dark path increases the peril you face. North Korea is not the paradise your grandfather envisioned. It is a hell that no person deserves."
That was the president speaking last week in Seoul, South Korea. We're going to shift gears now. We're going to speak to Tom Weitzel. He's the police chief of Riverside. And, Chief, I wanted to have you on. We talked about this issue before, the issue of the Justice Department expressing concern about sanctuary city, sanctuary municipality policies with Chicago and Cook County. Justice Department looking to try to take some grant money away as a way to try to get rid of those kind of status regarding undocumented immigrants. And it could have a spill-down effect, a trickle-down effect on many suburban police departments. Chief, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. Good morning. And you're correct. These grants funds that we're talking about here are federal funds coming from the U.S. Department of Justice. And they've been handing these grants out competitively since 2006. But they've announced that because of the, at least in the Cook County area, because of the feud between the President Trump and the Emanuel administration, that they may not be giving those funds to Chicago, and then subsequently they would not come to suburban agencies in Cook County, which we heavily rely on for training and equipment. So whatever the Emanuel administration and the Trump administration, when they're feuding, it's not only affecting the city of Chicago, it's affecting every police agency in Cook County.
So we did have a court ruling that said that the Justice Department had to award these grants, that they couldn't use that sanctuary status issue. But that's still evolving through the court system. And unlike what this grant money might mean for Chicago or even in the Cook County Sheriff's Department, it takes on a more heightened role when it comes to suburban police departments and their funding.
It does. I mean, these grant funds that we request are usually no match, which means that the local municipality does not have to put up any money. You have to submit justification. But a lot of it is for basic services such as police radios. Municipalities buy squad cars to offset from their budget. There's been agencies that have bought canine units. They've bought dogs and the equipment that goes with those dogs. And in my own community, we've purchased police radios for our officers and something as simple and straightforward as ballistic vests. So bulletproof vests, we've also offset our costs for our officers. And that's really basic police services and equipment.
And it's money that doesn't have to come directly out of the local property tax dollars.
No, and in many of these suburban communities, it's we don't have the tax base of the city of Chicago. I mean, these what they call these Edward Byrne judicial grants, they can be around $2.5 to $2.8 million totally. A lot of times the suburbs get around $800,000 to $1 million, but it's distributed between the agencies. And if we don't get those, some agencies, it's as much as 2 to 3% of their total budget. So it can have a huge impact. And, you know, there's been this false narrative that because of the sanctuary city, in Chicago's case, that local municipalities aren't complying with that, somehow that's justified that the Trump administration and the Department of Justice keep this money from municipalities, and it's not. You know, suburban police agencies have been following those general orders and policies long before even the Trust Act was passed in Illinois. And the Trust Act did not make Illinois a sanctuary state. It just laid out verbatim what law enforcement has to do per the law. And 95% of the suburban law enforcement agencies were already doing that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Trust Act, because a lot of people who are critics of that label it as legislation that has made Illinois a sanctuary state, and sanctuary being kind of the pejorative term here. The real issue of the Trust Act was that it basically said you cannot that a person cannot be detained solely on their immigration status, but that there's nothing that prohibits talking to ICE or anything else, but that there has to be a definitive judicial order to hold someone.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, the Attorney General in Illinois put out a guidebook for law. Once the Trust Act was put into law, the Attorney General put out a guidebook for law enforcement that just told you exactly what you have to do to comply with the law. And my agency, for example, was already doing that, because what it said is you can't hold anybody longer than you normally would in the process of whatever you're holding them. So if you have somebody for a drunk driving arrest and it takes you 4 hours to process them, you have to bond them out on that 4 hours. You cannot hold them for immigration status. You cannot hold them for ICE telling you I'm going to come to your station in 24 hours to pick up somebody on a detainer. Your response is no, we're releasing that individual. He's not being held on the immigration detainer alone. We're releasing them. We are already doing that. But yet the Trump administration is trying to tie that to these grants that are being distributed to local municipalities. And it's just not factual. They're not doing that.
We're speaking with Tom Weitzel. He's the police chief of Riverside, Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. We're speaking with Tom Weitzel. He's the police chief in Riverside. We're talking about this issue of the dispute between the Trump administration and the Justice Department versus elements of Illinois, the Emanuel administration, Cook County, and the issue of sanctuary status, as it's being called, and how that could affect suburban police departments when it comes to grant funding. And, Chief, as you alluded to with the Trust Act, I think, you know, and again, it's become kind of a big political issue as we get into the gubernatorial campaign season among some elements, some critics of this. But I'm curious, I mean, for the most part, it was my understanding that the chiefs of police were supportive of the Trust Act.
That's correct. In fact, the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police was in support of it and did support it. And that one of the main reasons we supported it is because we're already doing almost all law enforcement agencies are already doing what the Trust Act now codifies that we do and puts down a set of procedures of what we can and can't do when it comes to individuals that come into our custody who may have an immigration detainer, which is different than a warrant.
And I want you to explain that too, because that's really kind of what the issue was, is that a warrant, you're holding them. That's the judicial issued warrant, but the detainer, that was the one where issue was being taken with.
Yeah, correct. The detainer is not a warrant. It's meaning it's not signed by a judge. The detainer is signed by an immigration hearing officer, and it does not require that law enforcement hold them against their will or hold them until ICE picks them up, and which a warrant would do. But these immigration holds, as they're referred to in law enforcement, which is an immigration detainer, says, hey, when you're done with the individual that you are processing on your arrest, we'd ask that you hold them for up to 48 hours on the detainer until we, ICE, can come and pick them up. And that you cannot do that. All the law enforcement agencies I know was not doing that. But now the Trust Act says you can't do that. You can hold them on warrants, and there are ICE warrants that are out there. I mean, ICE does issue actual warrants. It's just that they're so far and few between the number of warrants that they issue for the number of detainers that they issue. So we're already not doing that. My agency has never been doing that. The West Suburban Chiefs that I deal with, they've never been doing that. But just the Trust Act just made it the law, and now it's down on paper. So, I mean, I don't understand. When I wrote a letter myself to the Attorney General in Washington, to Jeff Sessions, and said, by withholding grant funds, with your dispute nationwide and more so with the Emanuel administration, put politics aside, you're affecting everyday police officers and the job they do and the services we deliver to our communities.
And the fact is, a warrant, that's a, through a judicial process, and there has to be basically a judge finds cause for the issuance of a warrant.
Absolutely. So some law enforcement officer, in that case would be an ICE agent, would have to go in front of a judge, in this case a federal judge, tell why the warrant should be issued, lay your case out, and the judge would have to decide. That doesn't happen in immigration detainers. They're administrative detainers asking law enforcement to cooperate, not ordering law enforcement to cooperate through a judicial warrant.
Has in these, I know this was a kind of a federal case on the most immediate here in Chicago on the issue of these Justice Department grants, but have the suburban police chiefs or the chiefs of police association weighed in as a friend of the court in these cases?
They have at the national level. So the International Association of Chiefs of Police have weighed in. On the local level in Illinois here, the individual police chiefs and individual police associations throughout the state have written letters to both the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions, giving our position on why these grants should be allowed to go through. But on a more of a global, yes, the international chiefs have weighed in through their opinions through the Friends of the Court briefs that have been filed on behalf of law enforcement nationwide. Because, you know, the burn assistance grants are nationwide. They go to local police, metropolitan, college police agencies. They go to tribal police agencies. So there's not a single law enforcement agency in the United States that doesn't benefit from those judicial grants.
Chief, I want to, just the couple of minutes we have remaining, I want to switch gears here a little bit. And we've talked in the past about the issue of the opioid crisis that has just swept this nation completely. And obviously, states trying to respond, municipalities trying to respond to it. I was wondering if you can tell me how you assess the situation. Is it deepening? Is it getting worse? Is the problem just spiraling out of control?
In my opinion, it is getting worse, and I think law enforcement now is just playing catch up. And it's funny that we would be talking about this, or really more appropriate, because grant funding plays a huge role in how law enforcement is addressing the opioid situation. Because we're applying for grant funds for everything from Narcan kits to preventative training to officers going into schools and college campuses. Those can be put in through the burn grant. But as far as the getting out of control, it is easy. And you know, some of your listeners may think, oh, this is something that takes place in an inner city in the back alleys and stuff. Well, I can assure you that this crisis is happening in the suburbs too, and it's happening in our homes. My own agency, for example, small suburban community like Riverside was 9,000, beautiful community designed by a guy named Frank, a lot of Frank Lloyd Wright homes. Fred Olmsted designed the landscape. We've used our Narcan kits 6 times already to save lives of overdose victims, and all of those have taken place in homes. They're not out on the public street. They're not at the schools. They've taken place where we've received calls of usually heroin-addicted people who have passed out or who have overdosed, and their parents call us. And these kids are between 16 and maybe 25 years of age. And they're taking place in the bedrooms in the basement of these homes. So if it's happening in the suburbs, I mean, it's not just an inner city problem. I'm sure you know that, but it's happening throughout the nation.
It's not just an inner city problem. It's not just a problem among the poor. It's everywhere.
It is, and we're playing catch up now by being trained, by giving the equipment. My own Narcan kits that I have, every single police car in Riverside has one, was fully funded from a grant from an organization in Riverside called the Riverside Women's Junior Charity. They paid for everything. And they're not cheap. The ones the police use are pretty expensive, and the carrying cases and the replacement costs. So in a lot of suburbs, too, the police end up being on scene before paramedics just by the nature of our job, that the officers are out on the street on patrol. So in small suburban communities, there's a very high likelihood that when you call for an ambulance for an overdose, that the police officer will be first on scene. So now we're starting to play catch up and have the right equipment and the training we need to address the crisis. And you know, you may have known this. I'll give this. This really upset me. About 6 months ago, Riverside, we had a 19-year-old that we saved from a overdose, and it was locally publicized in Riverside. And I, to my surprise, I received a lot of angry emails and voicemails from people who thought we should not be expending resources and deploying these Narcan kits to save people who are going to, in their opinion, just go right back to the same thing. And I was astounded that I would receive these negative phone calls. So I don't think people, we need to educate better. You know, if it was your son or daughter, I'll bet you wouldn't be calling the local police chief in your community saying, I don't think you should carry these, because they actually save lives.
Perhaps another sign of the civility or lack thereof that exists in society today. Chief Weitzel, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more right after this. We've gone past 8:01 on this Sunday morning. Time for the news. Here's Eric Rung.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We've been talking about how the president's been on this foreign trip to Asia. And while the president was away, elections held last Tuesday revealed some stunning discontent with the president and motivation among Democrats. Democrats got wins for governor in Virginia and New Jersey. They almost overturned the Republican majority in the Virginia House of Delegates. We'll be talking more about that later in the show. But in the meantime, there's also news that former Vice President Joe Biden doesn't seem to be shying away from a possible run for president in 2020. He spoke with Oprah Winfrey.
I have a regret that I am not president, because I think there's so much opportunity. Mm. I think America is so incredibly well positioned. But I don't regret the decision I made, because it was the right decision for my family. Oprah, no woman or man should announce they're running for president unless they can answer two questions.
Yeah.
One, do they truly believe they're the most qualified person for that moment? I believed I was. But was I prepared to be able to give my whole heart, my whole soul, and all my attention to the endeavor. And I knew I wasn't.
Were you still broken?
My family was broken. I was broken.
That's former Vice President Joe Biden. Joining me now on the phone is Israel's Consul General in Chicago, Aviv Ezra. And thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I wanted to have you on because we had Governor Rauner recently in Israel for a variety of talks. And I know that you were instrumental in putting this all together. And it was a trade mission. It was also a mission involving cooperation, involving university partnerships with the University of Illinois. Can you just give me a little summary of what took place?
Yeah, sure, gladly. I mean, my capacity here as the Consul General of Israel to the Midwest, we cover almost 9 states here. So one of them, and of course, we're located right here in Chicago. So for us, the main effort is Chicago and is Illinois. We try to reach out as much as we can to legislative officials, to elected officials, of course, governors, mayors, et cetera. And in that capacity, most of the time, we try to do the following thing. We try to connect the dots between Israel and the local state. In this case, of course, the great state of Illinois. We found out that there is a, you know, in my capacity as the Consul General, I'm trying to brand Israel here in Chicago. But we found out, and I found out after a year here, that the challenge is twofold, in a sense that people have a kind of an issue of perception of understanding what Israel is about. And you can find that in many conversations that I have here in Chicago, but also vice versa. You have Israelis that have a perception challenge, I think, when it comes to Chicago. People think that, you know, Israel is about, I don't know, camels and desert. And we all know that that's not the case. And Israel is about high tech and innovation. And people in Israel think that Chicago, you know, best case the scenario is about Michael Jordan. And worst case scenario is Al Capone.
It's still Al Capone, really?
You know what? You won't believe it. You won't believe how sometimes people are not familiar with, you know, with life. And in that capacity, I feel that I'm also trying to brand Chicago back in Israel. After all, this is such a great city, third biggest city in the United States, great communities, great universities, great business community and tech community. People are not aware of it. So the first goal that I have is bringing Israeli officials here and bringing local officials from here to Israel. And in that capacity, I invited Governor Rauner to come, and I was very happy that he came just recently. By the way, he was the fourth governor in this year from the Midwest coming to Israel, and also the mayor of Chicago just came back from Israel. So I'll gladly elaborate about what we did there.
Well, I know one of the issues, one of the big things that was accomplished was this idea of the Illinois Innovation Network and the
Correct.
Discovery Partners Institute, that this kind of high-tech incubator that utilizes the resources of the higher education community,
exactly.
kind of anchored by the University of Illinois, but basically using all of our higher education institutions in the Chicago yeah. area, and kind of doing these link-ups and partnerships with four university higher education institutions in Israel.
Exactly. I mean, a week before he came to Israel, he inaugurated in the South Loop that innovation center that you're mentioning with the mayor of Chicago and with President Killeen from U of I. And he talked about, you know, about the importance of connecting the universities to Chicago itself to make sure that people later on, the decision makers and the people that graduate stay in the loop. He talked about proximity to markets and the great business community. And then he talked also about the international ingredient in that innovation center. And for me, it was pretty clear. The international ingredient should have Israel in it. And the governor agreed, and he said for him, Israel should be the first in that sense. And in that capacity, he came to Israel. He brought with him President Killeen and a few of the deans from U of I, Dean of Business and Dean of Engineering. And the main goal was really to connect the dots between that innovation center here, which is in the process of being built, and the concept of innovation and technologies that Israel have as a startup nation.
And with the four universities, Ben-Gurion, Tel Aviv, Hebrew, and Technion, and I'm very curious about Technion because that sounds like, you know, a true futuristic type of higher education facility in Israel.
Exactly. I mean, first of all, Technion is the Institute of Technology of Israel, and about a few years ago, Technion has signed something similar in concept with Cornell in New York. And that was one interesting niche that the governor wanted to explore. He, as you said, met also additional three universities in Israel. Each one of them have their own added value to the cooperation. And it's pretty clear that after the visit where they signed four MOUs, all four of them are great potential for the cooperation. And now President Killeen and his team will explore and negotiate with all four of them to find the right best situated university to have an international component right here in the city of Chicago.
Very interesting things coming. We're speaking with Israel's Consul General to the Midwest here in Chicago, Aviv Ezra. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking to Israel's Consul General to the Midwest, who's based here in Chicago, Aviv Ezra. And I'd like to play this cut of Governor Rauner kind of recapping his conversations with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Israel suffered from many of the problems that Illinois suffers from. Too much government, too much bureaucracy, too high taxes, too much regulation, and sort of an anti-economy, anti-economic growth, anti-free enterprise mindset, sort of a collectivist mindset. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has changed that very dramatically. He's reduced government spending, focused on balanced budgets. He's cut regulations on businesses. He's reduced the tax burden. And he's made Israel much more pro-free enterprise, pro-growth. And since he's become prime minister, Israel's economy has really taken off like a rocket. It's very exciting to see. And he and I shared strategy and policy discussion around that. He understands what I'm dealing with, what we're all dealing with here in Illinois, and is very supportive and very sympathetic. And we exchanged ideas on how to make Illinois more pro-business and pro-growth.
So it sounds like the governor found a kindred spirit.
You know, again, I mean, the goals, one of the major goals of this trip is not just to enhance academic collaboration or just the business connectivity, but rather to cement the strategic partnerships between Israel and Illinois. And in this capacity, the governor did meet the prime minister. He also met additional ministers, Minister of Education and Minister of Strategic Affairs, and also the mayor of Jerusalem. I'm mentioning all of them because a lot of them come from the same background that the governor of Illinois comes from, which is more business-oriented, and then later on came to politics. And not really politicians that grew from a party, but rather businessmen that came, some of them actually from the venture capitalist world. So the conversations were, you know, the conversations were very focused on, again, cementing the strategic partnership and the values and the interests, but also talking about some of the background, and it seems some of them really fit the concept and the belief of Governor Rauner in terms of economics.
And I think, as you were talking about, you know, misconceptions of, you know, Illinoisans about Israel and about Israelis
and
towards
Israel
Illinois. But I think people forget about, you know, there is a tremendous trade component that exists. And I actually hadn't realized this till I did a bit of research that the oldest free trade agreement that the United States has is with Israel.
And you're right. The first free trade agreement. You're right. Exactly. Here, John.
And that marked 30 years in September. But I think people don't understand that business trade relationship that exists between Illinois and Israel.
Exactly. It's by the way, it's the business and trade, but also it is the R&D. And the focus on R&D between the two states, there is a joint foundation called the Bird Foundation. in which both Israel and the United States are putting the same amount of money to focus on R&D together. So leveraging more on the dollars and investing in the same challenges that both sides need to find solutions to. So that fund called the BIRD, the Binational Industrial Research and Development Fund, is something that is in existence of many, many years.
Well, and the governor indicated, and he had this conference call for reporters after he returned, and he kind of indicated that he believes that in speaking with some companies in Israel, looking for domestic partnerships or expansion in the United States, that the focus tends to be on the coasts, on California or New York, and that there isn't a great deal of awareness about Illinois and the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this goes exactly to what I originally stated, which, you know, we're talking about decision makers in Israel. And I think, by the way, this is an issue with all foreign governments. When they talk about the United States, they talk about either Washington, New York, maybe Miami, best case scenario, LA. They don't understand that the heartland is right here, and everything that grows and everything that works is built right here. And in this sense, I see myself as the bridge, because I want to bring decision makers from Israel right here. And the first step, by the way, should be a direct flight between Israel and O'Hare. That is just mind-boggling that we don't have it right now. We did have it in the, late 90s, but it was discontinued. So one of my efforts is bringing either El Al, our carrier, national carrier, to fly, or United, because this needs to happen sooner rather than later, and that will be the first really, the technical tool to connect the dots. There's no doubt about it. By the way, the Minister of Tourism of Israel was here about 4 or 5 months ago, with an official, I would say, offer to bring incentives to open this direct line between Israel and O'Hare, and it should happen sooner rather than later.
You know, that's the first I've heard of that. I'm quite frankly very surprised too, knowing what a international hub Chicago and O'Hare is.
Exactly. And think about it: if you're a businessman. I'll give you a very, very short example. United has inaugurated the flight to San Francisco, to Israel. They initially thought that once a week will work. They have a daily flight, which is packed, from Israel to San Francisco. So it takes about 15 to 16 hours to make it from Ben-Gurion International Airport to San Francisco, whereas the trip that the governor took to Israel took us much longer. Doesn't make any sense. Businessmen don't have time for that. They want to fly directly to Chicago to make the investments in the easiest and the most transparent manner.
So where do things stand on that possibility?
So the things stand the following. I'm putting a lot of effort in that vis-a-vis our national carrier, El Al, and we hope maybe to have something coming up very soon. And parallel to that, we are reaching out to United because we feel that it's also a right approach and I think a good line. And we have brought the Minister of Tourism here with an incentive package. Literally speaking, for us, it will be, of course, our interest to have the direct flight from the Midwest to Israel because of many of the tourism and the tourists that are coming, but also vice versa, to have Israeli businessmen and Israeli investors coming here to Chicago, being more involved in what's happening, more exposed to Chicago as a city with the capacity of making a lot of business transactions and foreign direct investment right here. There's no doubt about it that it should happen.
One last question. Yes. In reading I know Governor Scott Walker was also in Israel about the same time that,
yes,
that Governor Rauner was, and in reading some kind of a briefing that Governor Walker gave to Wisconsin reporters, the governor there mentioned how he invited the prime minister to come to the Midwest and to come to perhaps Milwaukee, and he said he tag-teamed this with Governor Rauner to come to Chicago, maybe St. Louis. Is there any possibility of that?
Yes, no doubt about it. I mean, one of the biggest achievements that I'll be able to achieve is if I get the Prime Minister of Israel to touch base right here in the Midwest. And the reason is, I mean, the Prime Minister is arriving to the States almost every year. Usually he comes to Washington, and then he has a touchdown in another city. Most of the time it's New York. I think it would be more than appropriate and right that he should touch down in the Midwest, and obviously he should do it right here in Chicago. There's a great Jewish community here, great non-Jewish community support of Israel, superb, you know, proximity to market, best university, superb businessmen. I don't need to sell Chicago to you, but I feel that I have to pitch Chicago also to Israel. And the governor, actually all four governors that I had the opportunity of taking to Israel in the last year, governor of Iowa, governor of Michigan, governor of Wisconsin, and the governor of the great state of Illinois, all of them invited the prime minister, and I'm in favor of him coming here sooner rather than later, maybe on a direct flight.
I was just going to say, maybe that El Al flight from Tel Aviv. All right. Well, Aviv Ezra, the Israel Council General for the Midwest, based here in Chicago, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It was my honor. Looking forward to having you in Israel, too.
We'll be back with more. Right. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with former Congressman and U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood of Peoria. Right now, though, we're at 8:32 on this Sunday morning. Time for the news. Here's Eric Rung.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio on North Michigan Avenue. And joining me on the phone is former U.S. Transportation Secretary, former Republican Congressman from Peoria, Ray LaHood. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Good to be with you again.
It's too bad you can't be here with me on Michigan Avenue. We just saw a guy go by with a cheese head, obviously the Bears-Packers playing today.
Right.
And
right.
I remembered I actually have a cheese head at home signed by Howard Dean.
Oh, my God. Wow.
Because Howard Dean had declared if he didn't win Wisconsin, he was getting out of this race. So I etched that on the cheese head and had him autograph it. And
yeah, great memorabilia.
He did not win Wisconsin. Well, I'm again, thanks for being on the show. And
thank you.
We spoke together out at Aurora University last week about the state of politics and the state of our politics today. And Secretary LaHood has authored a book, Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics, and we'll put a link to that. You can get it from Amazon and other booksellers. But one of the essential themes of this is about just how politically polarized and the lack of civility that we have in politics today. And it's kind of, we've seen it kind of span from the time that you were in Congress and all the way through being a member of President Obama's cabinet.
Yeah, you know, Rick, I think the best example of the lack of bipartisanship is what's going on in Washington today with the tax bill, where in the House this week, the House Ways and Means Committee, on a totally party-line vote, voted out a huge, huge tax cut bill. It comes to the House floor this week, probably Tuesday or Wednesday. It'll be a party-line vote. The Republicans will pass it. But your listeners who remember the day when Dan Rostenkowski, was chair of Ways and Means and worked with President Reagan in 1986 and took the time to work with the Republicans and Bob Michael, who was Republican leader. They passed a tax bill and they did it in a bipartisan way. And you know, those days are gone. And when you do legislation in a bipartisan way and you include members of the legislative body from both parties, it makes for good legislation. It makes for long-lasting legislation, and we're just not there today. We simply are not.
And to be fair, and you touch on this in your book, that you think one of the mistakes in the Obama administration was doing the one party only on Obamacare.
I do, Rick. I think that it became clear during President Obama's the first 2 years of his first term, the Congress under Democratic control, Pelosi in the House and Harry Reid from Nevada in the Senate, they had the votes to pass an $870 billion economic stimulus bill, you know, within 30 days of the time that President Obama was sworn in. And it was very It was very acrimonious, and it was done with Democratic votes because they had the votes to do it, and a decision was made by the leadership of Congress and the White House. We've got the votes. Let's do it. And the same is true a year later or a year after President Obama was in office. They passed a major health care reform with just Democratic votes, no Republican votes. And you've seen since Republicans have been in control, they've tried to change it, haven't been able to do it. But if that had been a bipartisan bill, you wouldn't see the kind of debate that's going on today because Republicans would have been a part of it. And those kind of calculations where the majority party thinks, well, we got the votes, let's just move ahead, do not prove to really be the kind of legislative process that enables good legislation.
Is it thus the law of unintended consequences that it just further creates that polarization?
There's no question about it. And obviously we've seen it played out with health care over the last several years with Republicans in control and trying to do away with Obamacare unsuccessfully. The truth is the economic stimulus bill did help the economy. It bailed out the auto industry and really, really helped our economy. And our economy is very strong right now, in part because I think President Obama and his economic people and the Congress laid the groundwork for it with that bill. But it would have been better to do it in a bipartisan way.
Let's go back to the tax bill for a moment.
Right.
We have the Republican version that's out there. The Senate unveiled its version of it.
Right.
There are some differences. One, a significant difference, and one I've been talking about on the air a lot here about the issue of deductibility of state and local taxes, that the House version limited deduction for property taxes to $10,000. The Senate version eliminates all state and local tax deductions.
That's a huge hit on Illinois, New York, and other big states. And I don't know if that will prevail or not. I know that some of the New Yorkers have already, Republican New York Congress people have already complained bitterly. I think you'll see some of them vote against the House bill when it comes to the floor this week. And then we'll see how that plays out in the Senate. But there are other provisions that are very onerous. I just think, it's going to be difficult, I think, in the end to reconcile what the House and Senate does and have a bill signed by the president by the end of the year. I think that's a lot of wishful thinking.
Well, and the Senate has, for Republicans, there's less margin for error.
Right.
They can only afford to lose two votes. And
exactly.
That in its of itself seems fraught with a great deal of difficulty.
Well, and then you look at what's going on in Alabama with their candidate. It's conceivable, Rick, that a Democrat could win the Alabama Senate seat. And if that happens, then they're in a real predicament because there's not the margins that they need, and you know that some Republicans are going to defect just simply because of their angst with the way the bill is going, and frankly, with obviously there's some Republicans that have a lot of angst with President Trump.
Well, and we talked about in Aurora, we talked about, how Jeff Flake has spoken
right.
out, how Bob Corker, an early Trump supporter, and then, here again, a consequence of the tweets where Bob Corker and, these guys aren't seeking re-election either, and they're seems
right.
they have more freedom, I think, now to say things than if they were still coming
right.
back.
Right. Well, and the other person that's obviously going to be a problem for President Trump is Senator McCain. The two of them have been going at it this weekend as President Trump visits Vietnam, and Senator McCain has been tweeting about the idea that he never mentioned any of the prisoners that are being held.
Human rights violations.
Exactly. And so you can see that Senator McCain, there's no love lost between President Trump and Senator McCain. So you add that to the Alabama calculation, if a Democrat were to win that seat, you add that to Senator Flake, Senator Corker, and then, you know, obviously always the wild card is Senator Collins, Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, Senator Murkowski from the state of Alaska, a Republican. So this is a very, very thin margin that they're playing with in the United States Senate when it comes to tax reform. And you saw it played out with trying to eliminate Obamacare, and these Republicans work their will, and we still have Obamacare.
We're speaking with former U.S. Transportation Secretary and former Congressman Ray LaHood. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. I'm speaking with former U.S. Transportation Secretary, former Republican Congressman Ray LaHood of Peoria. And, Mr. Secretary, we've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning, Rick. Mr. LaHood, a real quick question. Some of the political divide that we see in the country, I want to get your opinion. Is it a lot more social, cultural differences or economic anxiety? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron.
Well, it depends on the issue. I think when it comes to certainly issues like health care, immigration, those are issues that are, you know, issues that affect all Americans. And, you know, I think that they're more political issues than maybe social issues when it, you know, comes to other issues like the social issues, whether it be abortion or issues like that. I mean, obviously, those are, you know, issues that people pay attention to in a different way, and there's a different audience for those. So it really depends on the issue and you know what how people are talking about resolving it.
Well, but what about as far as, for example, social media? I think that's something that has helped exacerbate.
Social media is playing a big part. I mean, we see how the president communicates with his supporters, goes right over the established media, and uses tweets on a very regular basis. So uncommon for a politician to do that, but it's been effective for him. And obviously, social media plays a big role for politicians communicating their point of view or their message, and it's turned out to be pretty effective. And we see what happened in the last election when, you know, Facebook and other social media have been involved with the election process and the hearings that are going on in Washington around that.
I wanted to ask you about these elections on last week on Tuesday, and with election of Democratic governor in Virginia, Democratic governor in New Jersey, almost a Democratic overturning of the Republican majority in the House of Delegates in Virginia. Obviously, you know, people pay attention to the Virginia, particularly around the Beltway area, just because of the proximity to it.
Right.
But also, you know, is there any lesson for Republicans that can be drawn from what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the turnout, Rick, in Northern Virginia, and probably most listeners that are listening to your show, and most people in Illinois probably haven't seen the analysis, but the analysis shows that a huge number of women turned out to vote. There's almost a complete flip of the Virginia House of Delegates from Republican to Democratic, which hasn't been that way for 20 years. A huge number of people came out, and most analysts, political analysts, believe that these voters wanted to send a message to President Trump that they don't approve of the way that he's been operating for a year. They don't approve of what he's been saying. They don't approve of his policies, and it seems as though many of these people didn't vote, but believe now that the only way to send a message to President Trump and his administration is at the ballot box, and they did that And they turned out a lot of Republicans, and it was a clean sweep for Democrats. And I think now Republican leaders and Republicans generally are worried that this could carry over a year from now, as we have 435 House members up for election, U.S. House members, and a third of the Senate, that there's, you know, there's going to be some payback here from people who just think the president has kind of gone off the charts in terms of what he says, how he says it, and how he treats people, and truthfully, the fact that his administration has really only one significant win this year after being in office, and that's the you know, the nomination and approval of Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch, and they spent all year debating Obamacare and didn't accomplish anything.
Well, and when you look at Northern Virginia, and that's the suburbs, basically.
Right.
And you
right.
obviously, you know Illinois well, and you know these Republican congressional districts that are outside Chicago, suburban districts. But
yep.
but when you look at the Collar County results of 2016, those traditional Republican counties went for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. So already there was kind of an ominous sign there for some of these Republicans. And, you know, one of them obviously being looked at carefully is Peter Roskam. And you accelerate that with his role in whatever may result of the tax bill. It would look like there's some vulnerability potential here.
Well, and you know, Hillary carried by a very small margin the Commonwealth of Virginia, as you indicate, she carried the suburbs of Chicago, and yet and still, a huge number of people came out and voted for Democrats in Virginia, and it's likely that if Trump continues with some of his tirades against people and the way that he treats people and the way that he talks, that will energize people a year from now. And I think it's going to be very difficult, Rick, for the Congress to pass and have on the president's desk the kind of tax bill that they're talking about by the end of the year. These are complicated legislative issues, and I just think it's impractical to think that they can reconcile the differences between the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate by the end of the year. This is going to spill over into next year, which obviously leaders don't want, but it's complicated.
That's former U.S. Transportation Secretary, former Republican Congressman from Peoria, Ray LaHood, author of Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics. Mr. Secretary, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Really appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Riverside Police Chief Tom Weitzel, Israel Consul General for the Midwest based in Chicago, Aviv Ezra, and former U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this Sunday. Go Bears and go Dean Richards.